Welcome everyone to the National Park Nerd Podcast, episode 2, February 26, 2019. Today's a very special day in the National Park System as the Grand Canyon celebrates 100 years as our nation's national park in the northern Arizona desert. Sit back, relax, and enjoy today's episode of the National Park Nerd Podcast. One of the new segments of my podcast is going to be talking about hidden gems within our park system, whether it's through the National Park Service or through the Forest Department of Agriculture, but somewhere in the Department of the Interior hidden gem. And since we're still in February, I thought we would still try to include something from Black History Month and include something from the Underground Railroad in my home region of Southern Illinois in Pope County, and that's called Sand Cave. The topographical features of today's Shawnee National Forest, which include limestone bluffs, caves, dense forest, hills, rivers, it provided a crucial role in the Underground Railroad in the mid-19th century, mainly because Illinois was a Union state. Kentucky never seceded, but it had a very southern feel in the western part of the state, which is attached to Illinois. And as slaves escaped in the 1800s and headed north, the dense forest and rugged terrain offered natural hiding places. En route through Pope County, Illinois, the freedom seekers often used Sand Cave for shelter and protection. Sand Cave is located a few miles west of Crow Knob and north of the Miller Grove community. Unlike the high lookout point of Crow Knob, which was also thought to be used as a lookout position, Sand Cave was a deep and dark and secluded shelter inside the sandstone face. Other topographical features on the Shawnee National Forest that may have been used as hiding spots along the Underground Railroad include the Oxlock Cave, Brasher Cave, and Fat Man Squeeze. The information about the Underground Railroad is part of a geolocated multi-forest interpretive program. Please contact the U.S. Forest Service in Washington, D.C. for more information. If you want to see pictures and videos of Sand Cave in the Shawnee National Forest, please go to thenationalparknerd.com. Or find me on Facebook and Instagram, and you'll see pictures there as well. Grand Canyon National Park has always been at the center of a tug of war between preservation and profit. Teddy Roosevelt in the early 1900s advocated for protection of the Arizona Canyon, saying, quote, "Man can only mar it." End quote. A century of legislation and litigation has aimed to stave off the impacts of mining, tourism, and development. But as the park celebrates its centennial birthday on February 26, those pressures remain. The park's more than a million acres continue to touch off debates over how to balance environmental safeguards with the recreational enjoyment and business interests. House Natural Resources Committee Chairman Raul Gravalia, a Democrat from Arizona, on February 23rd announced he will introduce the Grand Canyon Centennial Protection Act, legislation that will permanently ban uranium mining in the surrounding area. Meanwhile, a group of tribes with ancestral connections to the canyon are trying to redefine their relationships with the agencies that now govern it. The debate stemmed from the value of a place so remarkable that seeing it has become part of being an American, said John F. Ross, the author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's perilous journey and his vision for the American West, on Canyon's early explorers. Quote, "The Grand Canyon has changed every one of us, often in profound ways," end quote, Ross told Bloomberg Environment. Today marks the 100th birthday of Grand Canyon National Park, one of the true icons of the American West and one of the best examples of success of our national park system. But even with that said, the Grand Canyon is under constant attack from both sides, from the tourism side and the fact that it's the second most visited national park in our system, to the exploitation of Native Americans by trying to build tourist attractions on the outside of the national park, to the constant mining of uranium and uranium ore in the Grand Canyon and the Colorado Plateau. For nearly 20 years, a trio of 5-gallon paint buckets sat near the taxidermy exhibit at Grand Canyon National Park's Museum Collections Building. But those buckets, it turns out, weren't holding paint. they were actually loaded up with uranium ore, a naturally occurring rock rich in uranium that gives off potentially dangerous radiation. More than 200 million people have visited the Grand Canyon since it became a national park back in 1919. It saw more than 6 million visitors in 2017 alone, making it the nation's second most visited national park after the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee. But it hasn't always been appreciated as an American icon of the West. A white explorer in the 1800s once wrote that his party would surely be the last to venture into this, quote, profitless locality, end quote. Early Europeans who saw it found it a treacherous place and often invoked terror and fear. But John Wesley Powell, a geologist and geographer who took a perilous journey down the entire Colorado River through the canyon back in 1869, helped make the place comprehensible. His trip brought national attention to an area that indigenous communities had also inhabited for thousands of years. But since then, humans have impacted the Grand Canyon extensively. They brought non-native plants and animals into the park, such as bison. They polluted the air with nearby coal plants in Page, Arizona. And they've made noise with scenic flights overhead, with hundreds of helicopter flights daily over the Grand Canyon, all according to the National Park Service. The Colorado River was also dammed to supply water to millions of people in the West, including the areas of Phoenix, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, San Diego, etc. Development proposals have ranged from building housing near the park to also having a resort and tramway on Navajo ground that would go into the bottom of the canyon. When Powell became director of the U.S. Geological Survey, he often warned about overuse of land and other resources out in the West. If he were alive today, Powell would question the impact of mining and development and encroachment on this landscape. Quote, he's still telling us from the grave to look at these things, end quote, Ross said. So where did Grevalia's legislation come from? Well, uranium mining is being heavily debated as we speak on native lands outside of the Grand Canyon National Park boundaries. As far back as the 1870s, prospectors had staked mining claims within the canyon. In fact, the first major operation was the Orphan Mine, which operated from 1953 to 1969 and became one of the region's most productive uranium mines during the height of the Cold War. Globally, the uranium industry has been in a slump for years, thanks to the global glut of the mineral and relatively low demand. But plenty of uranium sits beneath U.S. soil, but current domestic mining companies can't afford to extract it at its current prices. Meanwhile, the administration and the courts have been engaged in a back-and-forth tussle over whether or not and where mining is allowed within the region of Grand Canyon. The Obama administration placed a 20-year ban on uranium mining around the Grand Canyon, which served multiple court challenges from the mining industry. The Trump administration, however, has signaled it would reconsider that temporary withdrawal, and it could possibly seek to protect the area for the mining companies, not for Grand Canyon. Grevalia's legislation would make the temporary ban a permanent one. He told reporters earlier this year he wants the canyon protected so his grandchildren can see it the way he does. National park tourism relies on a healthy environment, and uranium mining is too big of a risk to the ecosystem in return for a few jobs that are temporary, and it just is not worth mining in the Grand Canyon, according to Raimondo. But mining groups say the park is already protected from mining and that the ban creates an unnecessary buffer zone. Ashley Burke, a spokeswoman for the National Mining Association, recently told Bloomberg Environment, quote, given your increased and growing reliance on foreign sources of minerals, it is just public policy and bad public policy to further restrict domestic mining, end quote. And Energy Fuels Resources Incorporated, a Lakewood, Colorado-based uranium producer, has refuted criticism that modern mining techniques could create as many environmental problems as they did decades ago. Sophisticated technologies and close regulation of uranium mines, quote, ensure that the issues associated with historic mining practices cannot occur today, end quote, company spokesman Curtis Moore said last year. Senator Mike Lee from Utah and Senator John McCain from Arizona held a scathing press conference back in 2011 against Secretary of the Interior Salazar and the department itself. Senator Lee strongly felt that thousands of jobs were being wasted in the Arizona-Utah area that would have been created from a lax regulations on new uranium mining. They also felt that they had been undermined as legislators, that Secretary Salazar would put a ban on uranium mining for 20 years without the consent of Congress.
At the end of the day, this is about jobs. We're talking about potentially thousands of jobs on both sides of the Utah-Arizona border. Potentially thousands of jobs that could be in place for several decades. We're talking 3 or 4 decades. At a time when our country is so in need of job creation, we need to be doing everything we can to allow reasonable, responsible job creation. We certainly need for the federal government not to be taking action that would thwart job creation, particularly job creation in an industry such as this one that can produce energy that needs to be produced, especially where those same jobs are going to be sent elsewhere, probably overseas, if we don't allow those jobs to be created right here.
There's also this argument out there by the Canyon Mine and other mines ownership and bosses have stated that, you know, these jobs create a great economic wealth for the Northern Arizona region. And I wanted to dive in closer and see just how many jobs were created by the mines versus how many jobs were created by Grand Canyon National Park. And the results were staggering. Jobs that were directly supported by Grand Canyon National Park were 7,222 as of 2017. Now, as for the mines, as of 2017, there was one mine operating in the region full-time, and there only were 10 full-time employees at that mine. So, in a nutshell, the use of saying that this is an economic driver for the region, the Grand Canyon National Park and the health of Grand Canyon National Park seems to really outweigh the benefits of an economic driver than for uranium mining.
We are right in the front lines of water contamination, which is very scary for our small tribe. You can't go back and clean water once it's contaminated. You can't consume it. You can't live with it. You can't even live among it. And that's what we fear, basically for our lives.
Native American tribes with ancestral and cultural ties to the canyon are also uniting around environmental issues. The indigenous perspective of the canyon, a site central to the emergence and origin of stories of many of these tribes, have been lacking in the overall conversations. The Grand Canyon National Park centennial anniversary is giving tribes a chance to look at the stewardship of the land while also confronting a strained relationship with the national park that stems from a painful history. Tribes are looking at an economic opportunities that honor the canyon's sacredness and pondering how they can be better represented in tourism and other business ventures. Take a drive outside of the Grand Canyon towards Cameron, Arizona, and you will see shack after shack after shack after shack after roadside stand of Native Americans who have been suppressed for 100 years nearby the Grand Canyon National Park. In their eyes, you view the Grand Canyon like you view your mom. You have to take care of your mom, one Native American said. The issues raised over the Grand Canyon play into larger conversations about public lands and sustainability. People love national parks for the plants and animals that live there, which are threatened by climate change, said Stephen Nash, author of The Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. National parks came from the determination that some resources can't be given to the highest bidder, Nash said. Leaders need to have the same resolve to act on the issues facing them now, he said. This is a legacy that Americans 100-odd years ago had to be resolute about, Nash also said.
Every single mining site in this area, the closer we look, the more contamination we find. And if groundwater, for example, is contaminated by these deep uranium mines, it's really impossible to reverse that contamination.
The Canyon Mine sits on top of the deep red wall aquifer and the shallower perched aquifers, which feed the seeps and the springs in Havasu Canyon, which is where the Havasupai have lived for generations. The Havasupai are worried that given the toxic legacy of uranium mining on the Colorado Plateau, that the mine could contaminate their sole source of drinking water. And not to mention, the Colorado River provides over 40 million people in the American Southwest with drinking water. What's to become of all of that if uranium is seeping out into the Colorado River, through all the dams, into the lakes of Lake Mead, and on into our homes and in businesses? But this is not the first time that the Havasupai have protested the uranium mining. The tribe has been actively fighting Canyon Mine since the 1980s, when they first learned of the plans to extract uranium ore from their Aboriginal lands. The tribe challenged the Kibaib National Forest's decision to approve Canyon Mine in 1986, but they lost their appeal in federal court in 1991. The volatile uranium market, as we've spoke about before, would prevent the company from drilling the mine shaft and hauling ore. But when the uranium market finally rebounded in the late 2000s, a frenzy of new uranium claims popped up in the greater Grand Canyon region. They were shown a map, and it was just dotted with lots of yellow spots, and they really couldn't understand what they were even looking at. When you dive into the science of uranium and how it's extracted from the earth, it gets very scientific, and unless you've been an engineer or you are a geologist, you really don't really know what you're looking at. Meanwhile, the Canyon Mine threatened to reopen in 2009. Prompting the Havasupai to gather at the base of Red Butte, their ancestral homelands, to conduct prayer ceremonies and raise awareness of uranium mining around the Grand Canyon. Now, over 8 years later, gathered in the same spot, the Havasupai are again praying for their sacred mountain, the water, and future generations who will inherit this fight. While the persistence and stance of the Havasupai tribe have not wavered, a lot has changed over the years. Red Buttes became a traditional cultural property. It's a designation that requires tribal consultation for any federal development that could impact the site. Uranium mining is included. The U.S. Geological Survey found that 15 springs and 5 wells near uranium mines in Grand Canyon watersheds have dissolved uranium concentrations that exceed safe drinking water standards. And in 2012, the then Secretary of Interior, we've quoted, Ken Salazar, issued a 20-year mineral withdrawal, banning all new uranium mines around the Grand Canyon. But despite all these advancements, the Forest Service still allowed Canyon Mine to resume operations more than 30 years after its original approval without a single revision or update to its 1986 plans of operations. There are many entities that are challenging the Forest Service decision. And now with the tribal consultation and new environmental impact statements evolving over time, the Ninth Circuit of Court of Appeals has heard oral arguments in the case to try to prevent or to allow Canyon Mine to operate. But in the meantime, operators at Canyon Mine have perforated many of the shallow aquifers in the final stages of drilling the mine shaft. So that means an already full contaminant pond meant the owners needed to find someplace else to put the water that they had filled in the shaft. So, they created water cannons and shot sprays of radioactive mist into the air last April in an attempt to speed up its evaporation. Tests of the pond water showed a dissolved uranium concentration more than 4 times the federal drinking water standard. Also adding to this fray is the fact that radiation was also found in the Grand Canyon Museum several weeks ago after uranium ore had been stored there for over 20 years, and had only recently, of last March, actually been found to be releasing radiation. Thousands of people have possibly been exposed to this radiation over time. So as we're sitting here on Grand Canyon National Park's birthday, we've got Native American issues that have been there for over 100 years. We've got the exploitation of the uranium ore within Grand Canyon National Park, and the bitter fight between the administration and members of Congress over how to protect and move forward and to balance the people's love of nature in the national park and the exploitation of uranium mining, and also to just leave the park in its natural state. The Grand Canyon has been around for millions of years, but it's been a national park for now for 100. It's our duty to protect this area as we protect our own neighborhood going forward so that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren can enjoy it the same way that we do, and to help those that live around the Grand Canyon provide safe drinking water without having to worry about uranium mines or other people trying to take profits out of the Grand Canyon National Park. I want to thank Bloomberg, Vice News, Grand Canyon Trust, and the National Park Service for source material for this podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll have interviews with travel hacks experts, chiropractors, and people to help you get started in either hiking or trail running, and other various interviews and other side notes and hidden gems within our national park system. But for now, I want to thank everyone for listening to episode 2 of the National Park Nerd Podcast, and I'll see you next time.